on this episode of Edge of the Web.
Instead of being, you know, on a march toward obsolescence, let's listen to what the customers really want, what they really need. And one of the key ideas in the book is that two-thirds of our marketing is occurring without us. So we don't have a choice. We have to be invited into those conversations because that's where the magic is happening today.
Your weekly digital marketing trends with industry trend-setting guests. You're listening and watching Edge of the Web. Winners of Best Podcast from the Content Marketing Institute for 2017. Hear and see more at edgeofthewebradio.com. Now, alongside Tom Broadbeck, here's your host, Aaron Sparks.
And like I said, welcome back to The Edge. Thanks for joining us today on our live stream. We're broadcasting from Edge Media Studios located in downtown Indianapolis, Indiana. Every week on this show, we're bringing you some cutting edge digital marketing news and tactics and talking to marketing influencers from around the planet. Thanks for joining us. Like I said, again, hey, we're always happy to be able to have you on the live stream. To our audio listening audience on podcasts, we'd love to have you in these live pockets. So you can join the stream and be able to comment and talk to the guests that we're interviewing. That's always making a great, unique experience and you know, really leveraging what live is all about. So we certainly appreciate all of our fans inside of the audio platform. But join us. Join us on the live stream on a regular time, 3 p.m. Every Thursday Eastern time. All right, so check out all the recent shows and everything that we're doing on the show over at edgeofthewebradio.com. You can get the audio, you can get the interview blog post, you can get the show notes, everything that we're putting out there in the ecosystem. You can come right there and see it. We're powered by Site Strategics, the parent company of Edge Media Studios. We're the title sponsor, and if you're interested in who Site Strategics is, we are an agile digital marketing firm, and we focus on results-based shifts in tactics to be able to continually evolve and stay atop of all the changing platforms and technology. So if you're interested in what we could do for you, just simply go over to sitestrategics.com and touch base with us. Give us a phone call or contact us. We'll be happy to have a free hour to talk about what we could possibly do or what we see that could be applied to your digital marketing success. I'm Aaron Sparks, the owner and CEO of Site Strategics and founder of Edge Media Studios. The reason we talk about this all the time, the reason why we do what we do is twofold. We continually want to be able to unpack and demystify the digital marketing space. There's so many things that are changing. We're going to be talking about that today. So many changes that go through on a regular basis and what you need to be aware of, as well as, you know, it's a very selfish secondary reason is because we want to be able to keep us ourselves at the team here at Site Strategics educated on a regular basis to be able to know how to do the best work for our clients. So again, that's us in a nutshell in the production booth today. We've got Tom Broadbeck. He's manning the helm over there, director of digital media. Tom?
Hey, I unmuted my mic this time, so we're good.
Yeah, awesome.
You know,
awesome.
I was prepared. I felt your tease coming, and so I was able to prepare.
I'm glad you're with it. Yeah. After with show 304, you know, you're
there.
You're with me now.
No more 301 jokes. No 302 jokes. So we're good.
Oh, there are, you know, data codes for 304 too.
Are there?
I mean,
okay.
Yeah, we can go through the entire lineup.
I know there's like 308. So.
great jersey. I love that. I love the orange Site Strategics jersey.
My but. My hunting shirt.
Really? I didn't know that about you.
No.
No? Nothing. All right. Well, we certainly want to introduce our guest who's on the line for the show today, Mark Schaefer, marketer extraordinaire. Sir, how are you doing today?
Oh, I couldn't be better. I'm happy to be back. One of my favorite shows.
Well, thank you, sir. Now, you've been on the show three times, and we've got to have a prize for that.
I was going to think, SNL does the five-timers club, so we need to start a three-timers club and have special jackets.
Well,
I've
got something to look forward to then.
We had a mess of Edge of the Web cookies for our 300th episode. I'm just thinking that if you're making a three-time appearance, we got to get you something. So
I should. I'm breaking new ground here.
Three for three. Yeah, absolutely. So we certainly appreciate coming back on, and we always appreciate talking to you about your recent books. And you got a stellar one that we want to talk about today. But first and foremost, we always bring the latest digital marketing news. You ready to dive into that?
You bet.
All right. So let's stay on top of all the digital marketing trends. Roll that beautiful beam footage, sir.
I'm going to do what God put Ron Burgundy on this earth to do. Have salon quality hair and read the news.
This week's trending topics.
All right. So out of the gate, and this is something that we're really passionate about, podcasting, as you well know, over at Charitable from Dave Zorob. Here's why we're entering the golden age of podcasts. So the article really kind of leads into where we've been in podcasts. And podcasts have been around since 2004, but unlike any of the text-based news and blogs, which have gone through waves of centralization and disruption thanks to Facebook and Google, the podcast industry has remained stubbornly decentralized. And that's what I like about it, is because it's a fractional consumption. You can dial into exactly what you want to pay attention to for your knowledge and for your interest levels. It's not compounded into some generalized platforms. There are dozens of popular podcast players, no single gatekeeper in the industry. Despite many attempts, there's never been a Netflix of podcasts, right? Now, Spotify just came out and they've bought Gimlet, right? Gimlet Media, a premium podcast studio, and Anchor, a podcast hosting platform, for $340 million earlier this year. That's a lot of money for the industry. That was just sized as about $314 million in 2017. So the article goes on and quotes the CEO of Spotify. He explicitly referenced Netflix strategy as part of their motivation. But they're helping usher in the golden age of television, a sharp increase in the number of quality and new scripted shows alongside HBO, Hulu, and Amazon. So it goes through a number of insights regarding the 2000s.
Yeah, there's some great stats here.
Yeah.
2019, January 2019 study from CBS News said that 20 million more people listened to podcasts over last year. The content exposure, there's an average of 575 podcasts that are started every day.
Oh, my gosh.
And the number's just growing. So there's some, the website's Chartable, so they have a bunch of charts and everything on here. But so there's some great info in there. And I know Mark does the show with Tom Webster, and he does studies about podcasts all the time.
Yeah.
So I'd love to hear Mark's thoughts on podcasting. We were talking a little bit before the show.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. Jump on in, Mark. What do you think about this article and just the podcast environment, the era that we're in?
Well, I think it depends on how you define the golden age of podcasts. I think the golden age of podcasts really is right now. And I'm fearful, really, because every time an article comes out like this, we're in the golden age of podcasts, or podcasts are the hottest thing, I die a little bit inside, because what's going to happen is what always happens, is when something gets hot and the big companies get involved, and we have, as you said, this nice sort of like fractionalized, melting pot of podcasts, and it's going to become institutionalized.
Oh, man, yeah.
It's going to become, and then the smaller players are going to be pushed out. The smaller podcasts are going to be pushed out, because then you're going to have higher and higher production values. You're going to have more and more promotion. Mm-hmm. You're going to have networks that are forming. And we see this in every single platform, right? So there used to be lots of TV networks, right? They all consolidated into a few. They kind of like ebb and flow and ebb and flow. Same thing with social networks. We used to have dozens of social networks. Now we, 98% of all marketing money is put into, I think it's 6 or 7 networks. That's all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the same thing is going to be happening with podcasts. I'm delighted that podcasts are popular. I mean, I guess, I've had the Marketing Companion show for 6 years now. So, I kind of got in kind of early, and we've built a big audience. So, maybe we're ahead of the curve and we can hang on for the ride, but, it's like, Anytime something gets hot, then everybody piles on, and it creates content shock in that platform.
No, that's right.
Category.
That's right. And we've had previous conversations with you regarding the glut of content from blog posts in all different spaces. We were just talking about off air the LinkedIn videos and what's to come, what has happened in LinkedIn space with all the selfies and just a massive amount of not interesting self videos, right? So, not to put too much of a fine point on it, but there's so much. Now we're going to be impacted by another factor of those who do podcasts is that with the amount, 575 podcasts or something like that per day, you're going to have the audience can't keep up with all that fractionalized content.
Right.
So one, what you could count on over the years of growth, right, is now going to be leveling off, and we're going to be losing ground to so many different other venues, right? But it's going to actually dismay the consumers or the listeners, because you hook onto a podcast and they won't have the production value. And the content's not going to be as deep as some of the others. It's just going to dilute the value of podcasts.
Yeah, I don't know. I have a couple things. I love that podcasts are growing popular, but I think what could push back against a lot of these people who are jumping in is just it's tough work. It took us 3-4 years before we actually saw like an audience really start to build with our show, and I don't think people are patient enough for that side of the thing. But the other thing I wanted to bring up too is I don't think the technology is quite there yet either for people to find all these podcasts.
Yes. Discoverability has been a problem.
Yeah. So being able to promote your podcast, I mean, there's not really ways to do that within these platforms. That Apple, Google, they don't really know how to handle this phenomenon that's coming through. They're doing it as best they can, but I think the podcast growth is growing quicker than the technology to be able to find and support all of them, and that could help balance things out too, I think.
No, I think you're right.
When content shock hits a channel, the consumers benefit because there's more choice, and it's also going to force the quality up. And that's happening in podcasting. Absolutely it is. And just in the last 2 years, we're seeing amazing new shows in this space. So the consumers benefit, but the podcasters, some of the little guys, some of the pioneers, get left behind. The marginal players get left behind as the space becomes crowded.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the level of technology, the quality of the technology, like you said, Tom, it's getting much more feasible to have a higher grade production. Right?
Yeah, the Google Home's nice. You can listen to podcasts, and that ties in nicely with the Google Podcast. I'm not sure. I'm not an Amazon. I don't know if Amazon's dived into the podcast realm. I think that could be an area for growth for Amazon with their Alexa device, and that could be fuel some more growth there. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the solution is, but just being able to find podcasts, to find new podcasts that people are wanting to listen to without having to go to social to promote. It's tough.
Yeah. And it's very tough to even optimize. I mean, it is a advertising opportunity with cash out of pocket to be able to get content visible. And there's not a true good way to optimize podcasts. You only have a few factors.
Yeah, you have to have a second blog and that sort of thing to really see the money you put into a podcast.
Yeah, you better believe it.
Posting in iTunes.
All right. Is it time to regulate social media influencers? From our own Mark Schaefer here on Business Grow. I just said we own Mark Schaefer. Our own Mark Schaefer. Hey, let's have a look here. And actually, Mark, why don't you actually lead this article right here?
Well, this is sort of an unusual post in that I defend influencers. I'd say 99% of the copy on the web today is against influencers.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of that comes from a place of maybe jealousy because, hey, they're good looking and they're rich. but I think the reason I defend influencers and why I think influencers should not be regulated. Mm. Well, let's put it this way. They are regulated. I mean,
by the market itself.
Well, no. I mean, January 1st, 2013, the FTC came out with a regulation saying about disclosure. It's a disclosure law.
Absolutely.
And that is being ignored by a lot of people. And so that's why people are kind of up in arms, because sometimes it's hard to tell if people are being sponsored or not. Mm-hmm. But the problem is there are hundreds of thousands of influencers creating millions and millions of posts. It's impractical, probably impossible to monitor that. Now, the FTC has, they've dinged Kim Kardashian and a few big, high level people to sort of send a message. But the fact of the matter is, it's impossible to really regulate all those people. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, the responsibility is really with the companies. When you hire an influencer, you need to vet that influencer and do your due diligence, just like it was an employee.
Right.
They're going to be more famous than any of your employees. So why wouldn't you be very, very careful and be responsible? And the company has to do the monitoring, and the FTC needs to watch these companies. The third point I make in the article is that, I haven't seen any statistics on this, and there probably aren't any, but my guess is that more than 95% of the people out there who are influencers aren't getting paid. Hmm. They just love what they do, right? I mean, they're passionate about cars or fashion or shoes or marketing or whatever. They just love what they do, and they're posting content, and maybe they'll get some free gear or somebody from or something from some company. But most of the people out there who are posting content on products and mm-hmm. services that they love, it's these micro influencers or nano influencers that they're just doing it for fun. And that's most of the influencers out there. Mm-hmm. Even the influencers that a lot of the big B2B companies work with. IBM is an example. IBM doesn't pay their influencers. The influencers are getting exposure. They're meeting people and they're getting to go to maybe some meetings or something. But most influencers, aren't in that glamorous, famous category.
Right.
So the idea, I defend influencers that, look, these are people generally who are owning their voice and owning their power in this world and creating influence on their own. They're not waiting to be picked by some ad agency or by some company. They're picking themselves. And I think that's something to be celebrated, not something that should be dismissed as fluff.
No, and in the same vein, I highly agree with you. In the same vein, the shadow of regulation, there are so many slippery slopes there. Regulating, I mean, one thing's transactional, right? I we get that. But if you're actually, and you reference the Fyre Festival fiasco, right? I mean, that in its own right, you had, and if, for those who don't know what it is, please look it up, because it is a case study in what not to do. But there was a huge amount of influencers promoting an island party that didn't exist. And millions of dollars were in that bucket. And literally, the guy's in jail now for ringleading this entire influencer network.
My point in the article was, in that whole debacle, the influencers were the only ones who did their job.
Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of people are saying, they promoted this crappy festival or whatever. They didn't know it was a crappy festival.
Right.
If someone called me and said, hey, if some famous musician, established star, called me and said, I'm putting on a music festival down in the Bahamas. I'm going to fly you to the Bahamas. I'm going to host you for a week. I'm going to pay you to come down here. Mm-hmm. We're going to do some photo shoots. I want you to post a couple tweets all on me. I would say, you bet. Now, I don't know if it's going to work. That's not my responsibility.
No, it's not. And it's
so if you want me to promote it, I'll promote it. You know, everything I can see, it looks like it's going to be fine.
But Mark, I mean, in this environment, this ecosystem, or this era of social influencers, isn't it a bit behooving on the influencer to vet? I mean, it is important for them to make sure that they don't promote something that is less than genuine, right? So as much as the companies vet the influencers have to vet the companies and the product they're influencing.
Well, I think we're selling these people short.
Okay.
Because they know for them to exist and thrive long time, over the long term,
mm-hmm.
the one rule they can never violate is you can never reach the trust of your audience, period.
Yep.
You can't do it. These people aren't dummies. I can't imagine someone knowingly promote a defective product.
No, it's going to come back and bite them in a tenfold.
Right. So no one's going to have a career and be able to do stuff like that. So I think we just sell these people short. I think most of them are great people. They're professional.
Mm-hmm.
They're good business people. I think it's fantastic that people can build a career, being passionate about what they love.
Very good. Very good. Well, yeah. And I'm not a huge proponent of regulations in any way, shape or form. So I think like I said, that's a huge cliff to fall off of if the government gets involved in that space. That's the wrong play. You know what? Speaking of the FTC again, from the article over at Edge Engadget, FTC cracks down on fake Amazon reviews in a landmark case from Mariella Moon. Tom, give us a lowdown on this article. This is a pretty big thing here.
Yeah, so essentially what was happening was there's this weight loss pill that was paying AmazonVerifiedReviews.com to write and post fake feedback for its weight loss product. I went to that website wouldn't pull up for me, so I don't know what happened to that fake AmazonVerifiedReviews.com. But yeah, so essentially what the weight loss pill wanted was a 4.3 out of 5 stars on Amazon, and this place was writing fake reviews for them. And the FTC caught them. I didn't remember reading. There it is. $12.8 million fine for the company that was doing the fake reviews there. So Amazon's been dealing with fake reviews for a while.
Right.
And yeah, so hopefully I know Amazon's supporting this. There's a quote there. I scrolled past it. It says they welcome the FTC's work in this area. Amazon invests significant resources to protect integrity of reviews, blah, blah, blah. So Amazon's all for this crackdown from the FTC. And it rubs off not nicely against Amazon to have all these fake reviews on there, and people know that. So it devalues that platform for them. So, yeah.
You know, a couple things here. One, again, we were talking about government and regulation. Now, this space is transactional, truly visibly transactional, and it is influencing the buying habits of consumers erroneously. I mean, there is a argument to be made there, but how do they come up with $12.8 million as a penalty? No idea. I'm sure there is logic behind it. But, Mark, now we just talked about influencers in one space, and regulation. Here we have influencing anonymously or whatnot in the Amazon transactional space. What say you?
Well, I mean, it is a similar topic because reviews are influential, and the people that write reviews are influential. My only question on this article is, what took them so long?
Oh.
I mean, I read probably 3 or 4 years ago, Carnegie Mellon University, I believe it was Carnegie Mellon, had developed technology that could identify fake reviews like with over 90% accuracy.
Hmm.
So it's like, what took them so long? Because this is core to their product. They cannot let people gamify and corrupt reviews and their e-commerce platform.
Now, we harken back to Yelp and what they had to deal with fake reviews and they adjusted their not only their algorithm but the ability to perform certain reviews.
Yeah, doesn't Amazon have some sort of responsibility here? Don't you think? Like Mark said, that there's
absolutely there's
platforms or technology Amazon, you can do to identify them. How come Amazon's not doing that?
They've got to be all over it. I mean, there was a famous incident. There was a very well-known author in the marketing space who literally bought reviews for his book. And it was like really weird because every review was like six words.
Nothing.
I suspected something funny was going on there. And so he was called out at a conference. He was giving a speech. Wow. And someone from the audience asked him about the reviews and if they're fake. And he got so flustered, he admitted it.
Wow.
On stage. And, you know, then he tried to like get the videos to be taken down and anything and everything. But then it just sort of went viral and, the guy was embarrassed. But, he had 250 reviews and then his next book got like 25. So, but people pay attention to that stuff.
They really do.
Money to be made with good reviews.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't impact the Three Wolf Moon T-shirt.
Absolutely, or the sugar free gummy bears. If you want to talk about some beautiful reviews, go to the sugar free gummy bear posting on Amazon. It is a treasure trove of creative Classic. Writing.
Yeah.
But here's the thing is that, we just talked to Russ Jones, over at Moz about their domain authority, update here. That's going to be released, on March 5th. We really need to have a review authority measurement to be able to put against a product, put against a platform and be able to have, just like you talked about if there's a 90% accuracy of measuring content and reviews and accounts, right? Be able to have that as a vetting tool for the consumer, just like a consumer report. But for are these reviews real? I mean, that's a perfect space for an entrepreneur to jump in there and create something.
Well, I mean, there's got to be some stuff out there, and I know that there's been some AI work in that space, and I just see this as a first step with Amazon. It's just like the ongoing battle between Google and, you know, what used to be the black hat SEO, right?
Right.
You just knew Google could not let that win. They just couldn't let that win. And this is the same sort of scale of the battle for Amazon.
Absolutely. Here. Absolutely. So please, for all of our audience, jump onto the show notes. We have all the articles there. Certainly want to give a shout out to charitablebusinessgrow.com and Engadget. So some fantastic influencer articles over at edgeoftheweb.com as well. That's the news, but let's now deep dive with this week's featured guest.
Now it's time for Edge of the Web featured interview with Mark Schaefer, author of the new book, The Marketing Rebellion.
Deep voice guy teased it up for us, and we're going to jump in. Let's introduce Mark. There it is. He did that last time, too. It's a floating book.
So predictable.
So Mark is a globally known, recognized author, speaker, podcaster, business consultant who blogs at Grow, one of the top five marketing blogs of the world. He teaches graduate marketing classes at Rutgers University and has written seven best-selling books. Mark's new book here, and it was just floating on the screen, we've got a copy right over here as well. It's Marketing Rebellion, the most human company wins. It's a thrilling new view of business and a manifesto for human-centered marketing. The book has actually hit number one in both marketing and advertising categories on Amazon. So congratulations on that data, those statistics. That's fantastic. Congratulations on the seventh book. We were talking before the show. This book has a bit of a different wake that's happening for individuals and marketers that are picking it up and reading it. What's happening with your responses to this book?
Yeah, it's overwhelming, really, and quite unexpected. I mean, you never know what's going to happen when you send a book into the world. It's such a risk because it's the most, you can't take it back.
Do over.
You're defining your legacy and you can't take it back. And this book is a very provocative book. It challenges a lot of strongly held views about marketing and compares it to real world research being conducted by big companies like McKinsey and Deloitte and Accenture and Pew. And what I found is that marketing, we're misaligned. We're just misaligned. It's broken. And so a lot of people are going to read this book and well, literally one person interviewed me in a video show like this, and he opened up the book and he showed me in the first chapter of the book, he had written on the margin, "Oh shit." And so it starts out with some of those moments, but then it leads you, it's a book of hope and shows, look, we're in this together. Here's what we need to do to survive. And I expected there'd be some pushback, and there still might be some pushback, but the big response has been, this is what we needed to hear. Mm-hmm. People, I heard from three people in the last week that said, this book has changed my life. It's changed my business. There's a post on my blog this week about a woman in the UK who said she scrapped a CRM system and she went back into like really connecting with people in a human way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it changed my business in one day.
Oh, that's amazing.
She had two new sales. She had two new customers in one day. She was ready to give up on her business. And it's continued to roll and to grow. And so it's hitting a very strong chord with people. I think people are uncomfortable with how we use technology to abuse people and annoy people. I mean, what's a robocall? I mean, what even is that?
Right.
Whose idea is this? Is that, you know, marketing means that we're tricking people, annoying people. I mean, robocalls now, they like use your local area code to make you think it's someone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I just had my own number spoofed to somebody else. A guy called me and said, did you just call me? Selling something. I said, dude, that's not me whatsoever. And the guy literally knew.
We're just in this sickness.
Yeah, it's really.
And so in the book, I reflect on why I got into marketing, and I was really inspired by my first marketing book in my college class by Dr. Philip Kotler. If you took a marketing class, I'd say most people had this book, Principles of Marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Kotler said, marketing is a combination of psychology, sociology, and anthropology. Marketing is all things human. That's the coolest thing, coolest career you could ever have. But how many of us really think about it that way today? We think about automating and making it easy and spamming and, you know, buying a million names for $9.99. And, you know, we just lost our way. And yet our customers are crying out for human connection. There's a belonging crisis in our world. People are more isolated and more depressed. And more alone than any other time in history. And it's an opportunity for companies to use this technology and to use their resources in a way that lifts people up and helps make them belong. And that's really what the book is about. It's like this transition of really listening to what the customers want. The reason I call it Marketing Rebellion is I give a little history lesson in the beginning of the book and show how people have been rebelling against marketing for 100 years, and we just haven't paid attention. And here's the truth. They always win. Ultimately, they'll always win. They're winning now because they're you know, they're using ad blockers.
Mm-hmm.
They're finding ways to get rid of the stuff that they don't want. So instead of being, you know, on a march toward obsolescence, let's listen to what the customers really want, what they really need. And one of the key ideas in the book is that two-thirds of our marketing is occurring without us. So we don't have a choice. We have to be invited into those conversations because that's where the magic is happening today. You know, only one-third of the marketing is stuff kind of under our control. The customers are the marketers. How do we help them do our job? That requires an entirely new mindset. And as this, as I started to come to this realization, that was as I was writing the book, it made me question what it means to be a marketer today.
So we had talked earlier in the show about influencers, and to the point, to your point, the consumer is the ultimate influencer because of the intimacy they have with other potential consumers. You know, you are talking about a major pendulum swing because we have such a momentum right now for automation. We just talked about these LinkedIn selfie videos that are just glutting the system. There's such a momentum of just, I mean, the robocall is a perfect thing. There's a reason why that exists because it has a successful capture rate. It has to, or it would die on the vine. So as much as consumers are getting annoyed, the technology is running ahead of that and just trying out. And it's almost like the bloody Borg on Star Trek, right? You know, we're modulating the shields, and you know, you got to get in. And honestly, we're just trying to get to that consumer, and it's a continual battle there. Forgive the rogue Star Trek reference, but
no, I think it's a perfect reference. Because marketing is the same way. The Borg assimilated and adjusted to their environment faster than the humans.
Right.
And the humans hated it. The humans hated the Borg.
And it dehumanized the absorption of different species. I mean, literally cultural independency. So it is literally the marketing automation is just dehumanizing everything.
And in a world, and especially the digital natives, we see this especially with the young people today. Gen Z, they love shopping malls, of all things, because it's a safe place they can get together with their friends, you know, because they're young and their parents can drop them off and they can go and take selfies together or whatever they want to do. So it's like there's this backlash against technology and against automation. And I'm not saying stop what you're doing, unless you're doing things that people hate, then I am saying stop that. But there are some things that work, and there are ways to use technology to make yourself more approachable, more accessible, more responsive, more friendly, you know, more human. So if you're using technology to take down barriers instead of erecting barriers between you and your customers, you know, that's what we need to do. But we need to have a more human-centered approach to marketing. And so that is what the book is dedicated to. It's just filled with hundreds of different ideas. And again, I never tell a business what to do because there's no cookie-cutter answer that suits everybody. So this book, it's like a map. And you can kind of choose where you want to go based on what might fit for your business.
Was there a specific incident that inspired this book?
Yeah, actually there was. So whenever I write a book, it's because I get curious about something. I see some problem that I can't figure out. And I become obsessed, not in a healthy way either. I just become obsessed. Was like, what is going on? So I was going all around the world, and I meet with companies and executives all around the world, and big companies and small companies, and they're all telling me the same thing. They said, we're stuck, we're falling behind, Our technology, our marketing, it doesn't work like we thought it would. It's not working like it used to. And then I was in this meeting of chief marketing officers, mm-hmm. and I was invited to come in to be a facilitator. And so we had this table filled with all these famous people at huge brands, million dollar budgets, and the premium agency relationships. And we went around the table and they all talked about what was causing them problems. And every single person said, "We're falling so far behind." And I almost laughed out loud because I'm thinking, you know, come on, how can you be falling behind? And so my original hypothesis is that technology is just moving too fast and people feel overwhelmed. But when I got into the research and talked to leaders at all these, you know, many companies, mm-hmm. what I found is that the technology sure is moving ahead, but even more important and more profound, our customers have moved away from us. Hmm. Enabled by technology, you know, they're in control. There is no sales funnel. There is no customer journey. Hmm. They own it. They create it. And so I'm reading all this research. It's just like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, I've been in marketing, you know, for more than 30 years. And, you know, there's a backlash against loyalty. 87% of our customers shop around. In 90% of the industries that McKinsey studied, there was no evidence of loyalty.
Really?
Now, I'm a marketer.
Yeah.
That's what I do. And so literally, I had to rethink what marketing is. I had to reimagine marketing. And, you know, it was a big job. And it took me 2 years to do it. But that's the book. You can get 2 years of my life for $19.99.
that's the price of Mark Schaefer, everyone. Yeah. And a flight to the Bahamas. Yeah. Now, there are three parts to the marketing rebellion in the book. The first is the end of lies. And you said that this started 100 years ago. What happened here in that era?
Well, as I describe in the book, that, you know, consumers have from the very beginning have fought back about being controlled, mm-hmm. and advertising and marketing were sort of synonymous when it all started in the 1880s. By the late 1800s, early 1900s, advertising was sort of a mainstream way to monetize publications. Mm-hmm. And advertising back then was remarkable promises. And as the competition heated up, the promises became more and more remarkable to the point they were lies. The consumers revolted, mm-hmm. the government responded, and they created the FTC and the FDA, and it became a crime to lie to your consumers. And the second rebellion was against secrets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I started in business, in the 80s, you made money on the secrets. You made money on what people didn't know.
Right.
That's how you sold cars. That's how you sold insurance. That's how you sold just about anything. With the internet, the transfer of knowledge has moved from organizations and companies and governments, mm-hmm. to the people.
Absolutely.
But when you buy a car or insurance or a vacation package, you know more about it than anybody that's selling it to you. So that was the second rebellion, the end of secrets. And the rebellion that we're in now is control. Hmm. Many of our consumers are unreachable. So just think about my own personal experience. I watch more TV than I've ever watched in my life. I never see commercials.
Right. Absolutely. You can skip
on Netflix. Yep. Right.
Right.
I've got a big project I'm working on with a company in Atlanta. I drive down there once or twice a month, 3-hour drive down, 3-hour drive back. I listen to my radio the whole time. Zero commercials. Zero.
Yep.
I listen to Sirius XM. I listen to audiobooks. I listen to Spotify, maybe podcasts. Zero commercials. I don't see ads in my newsfeed. 1/3 of Americans have ad blockers. Hmm. So my personal consumption of advertising is down 95% in 5 years. And when people do see ads, they don't believe them anyway. So we've got to find a new way to enter these consumer conversations. And we can't buy our way in, because this is the third rebellion. It's the end of control. We do not control the sales funnel. We do not control, you know, the customers. We don't own the customers, mm-hmm. and we don't own the customer journey. We have to cede control to the customers. But here's the magic. When the customer becomes the marketer, your marketing stops, because they carry the message forward for you.
Absolutely.
So that's what we need to aspire to in this new era.
Are you venturing in the space of empowering the consumer to a much greater degree? Now, the consumers have control. I mean, it's like the consumers know that they control brand's reputation with reviews. They know where they now stand in the environment, and it's a buyer's environment now. Are you tackling how to empower that consumer to advocate on the behalf of the brand?
Yeah. Well, I think it's sort of a different mindset, you know. In Seth Godin's book, he says marketing is about changing people. It's about changing opinions, it's changing behaviors, changing votes, whatever you want to change. Mm-hmm. Marketing is about changing people. And I disagree. I think those days are over, because I think today, in the old days of marketing, it was about changing people, because the only way people could find out about your products was by what you're telling them.
Right.
But today, a brand is not what you tell a person. A brand is what people tell each other. Mm. So it's not about changing people. It's about respecting people and coming alongside them and say, you know, I respect your ability to make up your own mind. You have the accumulated knowledge of the human race in the palm of your hand. I think you know how to use it. What can I do to help you? What can I do to help you make money, save money, have a happier life, a healthier life, more entertaining life? Mm-hmm. You know, how can I help you be more, how can I create something that's authentic and interesting and relevant that you would love to share with your people?
It's about them, not you, from the concept of marketing. You're looking to serve their needs first. But I have to make a pit stop or a sidebar on the concept of the consumer. By and large, has all this information, but do they know how to use it? Do they know how to filter unbiasedly in this space to be able to compare apples to apples? Because we are also in the era of clickbait. And it's almost a blip verse arena from Max Headroom, is that our attention span is so small that the due diligence and actual time to spend reading documentation, reading online, finding out things, we are ADD on steroids now. How does the consumer know how to even look at something objectively? They're being pulled in a lot of different directions, and they have such a noise barrier in front of them. Yeah, they'll push back, but will they take the next step of actually doing the due diligence that you're ascribing to that consumer? That's a big question on my side of the fence.
Well, I think we're on a trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a certain demographic. If you're over 65, you still see TV ads.
Right.
If your market is over 65, you should be all over television. You should be all over cable news and everything else that generation looks at. Okay.
Yep.
So it's a trajectory of change. Now, one of the things we talked about early in the program was Amazon cleaning up their reviews. Okay. Now there's an example. Can people discern when there's fake reviews? The trajectory is, Aaron, mm-hmm. we won't have to. It's got to get better. The fake news has got to be figured out. It will be figured out. The fake reviews will be figured out. And so AI ushers in this age of assistance, where what, however we want to be helped, whatever we want to know, it's going to be faster, it's going to be more relevant, and it's going to be more accurate.
Yep.
The crap won't make it through the AI filters, right?
Yep.
Not right now, but soon. And that's the way, that's the trajectory.
Yep, I see where you're going. And
people can't trick them. You can't fool them.
Yeah.
And the people will be attracted to the companies that will stand up and say, I will never let you down. And there's not many companies that do that today. And it's a shame. I think it's a travesty that trust is a point of differentiation in our world today.
No, thank you for that, because that is absolutely the answer I wanted to. I mean, people are trusting the inherent filters of Google more and more. Google themselves are compounding on the trust factor on what they serve to their consumers, and you're seeing that abound in all the different platforms. People are trusting what they see more and more, because they see AI catching up and helping them. It's not there yet, but it certainly will be. And
I believe it will be.
And the consumer is knows that they can eventually trust the technology and the intent of the technology, because there's a need, and you know, the digital age will actually fill that need or be summarily dismissed. So there is a good factor that the consumers can rely on. That authenticity, that humanity of a company that you're talking about, it is almost counter insight that companies have been practicing for such a long time. They embraced the digital advertising realm. They've embraced automation. They've embraced lead flow. They've embraced all the different pockets of analysis to be able to see whenever that consumer is in the right spot. Right? They have bought in so much into this tool set that is constantly evolving. And what you're saying is, that has created the noise in so much that consumers have jettisoned away from that, and you're negatively impacting your brand with that level of automation, right?
Yeah. Well, and again, I want to emphasize that there is a place for technology, and I never ever will deliver a cookie cutter answer for anything. So. Mm-hmm. People, what I'm trying to do is just open people's eyes to the way the world is today and help them make an informed decision. But I'll give you an example. I got my lease was running out on my car, on my BMW. So I got four emails from four different people giving me different options from the same dealership. I didn't know what to do. So I finally contacted someone who was, you know, the internet manager, and she said, oh, follow the email from Josh. He's your sales rep. So I got this email from Josh. He gave me a deal on a car. I said, look, Josh, I'm going to be coming in Tuesday morning. It's the only day I'm in town the whole month. And this is the exact car I want. The one that you showed me in this document. Great. I go to there Tuesday morning. There's no Josh. I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. There's no Josh. I go to the receptionist. She said, oh, Josh, today's his day off. He's not coming in. I said, how is that possible? He wrote me an email last night confirming our meeting today. He said, she said, that's all that's automated.
Oh my gosh.
He didn't even know that went out. So I went to the manager and I showed him the offer. It's the first time he ever saw it. And the car they had promised me was not even on the lot. And I said, I'm just curious. How many appointments does a sales rep have to manage a day? He said, oh, two at the most. I said, are you telling me that this guy can't do his own email to schedule an appointment? And I showed up today to meet this person and nobody even knows I was coming here? Now that is over automation.
Absolutely.
We're looking for an easy button that isn't there. And we're looking, you know, we're intoxicated. We're addicted to technology and we've lost our way. And this dealership has lost a customer forever. because it just got worse and worse and worse. My customer experience got worse and worse and worse, and I'll never go back.
Yeah, it compounded the fact when you were there that they probably were nonchalant about it to a particular degree. They probably
won't. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Don't get me started. I got to watch my blood pressure.
And, Mark, I want to ask a question here from the bullpen. We're seeing a lot of companies now starting to take points of view with their marketing, taking up causes, whether political or environmental causes or anything along the lines. You talk about being a human-centered company or most human company wins. Are businesses using that to show their humanity? And should businesses be behind a cause?
Well, this is a very important question. And I have an entire chapter of the book dedicated to answering that. It's chapter 6. And I think it's probably the most important chapter in the book, or one of the most important. And the reason is why it's so important is because in this era of diminishing loyalty, there's one thing that can still earn long-term loyalty. And so customers are saying, if you want us to be loyal to you, you have to show us that you're loyal to us first. What do you stand for? Are you with us? Are you aligned with us? Take a stand. And by the way, you can't change your mind. Now, we see this happening with the Nike thing with Colin Kaepernick.
Right.
We see this, and once you get into it, there are a lot of companies doing this now, and they've been doing it a lot earlier than even Nike. And it doesn't have to be something so polarizing. It could be something that's positive. It has to be something that's unifying. But I think the key idea is companies need to really be in tune with what's going on with their customers and sort of be able to reflect that in their company positions and policies and their marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to say, again, it's not for everybody.
There's a huge risk factor there.
There's a huge risk. Again, it doesn't have to be polarizing, but there is a power there. And we're going to be seeing a lot more of it because these companies are looking at the same research mm-hmm. I was looking at to write my book. They see what's going on and what they need to do. And we'll be seeing more of it in the future.
No,
my advice is the best thing to do is just be seen. Get out there with your customers so that they can see you and trust you. And that's the best type of stand that you can take. Just be involved in what they're doing. Be involved in your community. Let them see you.
Excellent insight and excellent question, Tom. Thank you. You know, there's so much about this conversation that necessitates a much longer interview because it's you know, we've had radical candor before on the show, and this is a radical insight that so many people don't want to hear because we are heavily invested by and large with automation, and we've lost track of the fact that marketing is hard work. You can't set the bots to go and expect that they're going to be anywhere near authentic as just picking up the phone or, more importantly, visiting your customer, right? These are factors that are truisms. These are points of truth that have never varied. They've just been ignored.
Exactly. You're exactly right. I call this the constant human truths. We've just forgotten.
Yeah.
I mean, we're lost.
Yeah, it's a sad testament, but at the same time, if we see the pendulum swing where real companies embrace their humanity, right? And they're at risk of not being as efficient in their marketing, but the counterweight, the more valuable weight, is that you can kind of reignite the loyalty concept with consumers. And that will go a long way from an investment of time and resources. The subtitle of your book is The Most Human Company Wins. Like we're talking. We're talking about that in parenthetical points, but how do companies who may have never even known how to show their humanity, let alone just throw in the towel and just go with the Borg, how do these companies find how to be human in front of their customers?
Well, one of the great pieces of wisdom in the book comes from a guy I admire a lot. His name's Chris Savage. He's the CEO of Wistia. This is a video hosting and production platform based in Boston. And he said, you know, we were a startup and we were selling like crazy. And we were talking about our product a lot and we weren't selling a thing. And then for fun, we started to make these videos of people at work and showed our work environment, and they went viral. And people started signing up. He said, when we were selling, we weren't selling. And when we showed our humanity and showed ourselves, we started selling like crazy. Hmm. And I realized that our culture is our marketing. And this is a powerful insight. And it's a powerful path forward because the question was, how do you become human? I don't think you can fake it. And there's going to be a struggle for a lot of these big companies. That's right. Why they're failing. Procter & Gamble, a lot of these legacy brands are in steep decline. Unilever, same thing, right? Who's the, you know, how is Tide human? How is Crest human? Mm-hmm. You know, they've got to work on that. And they are working on that. And P&G is buying more local sort of brands. But I think the insight is it starts with the culture. If you are a culture that lifts people up and you're not afraid to show yourself, if you're approachable and accessible, responsive, friendly, Philip Kotler even challenges us in a recent article to be vulnerable, a vulnerable company. Who's ever heard of that? It's not easy. And I think many, many big companies will not be able to make the transition because their culture is legally approved. It's not real. Hmm. And people will sniff that out in a heartbeat.
Well, we're going to see this is the evolution of marketing. That's what we're really talking about. And sometimes the evolution of certain industries takes a major change a major realignment like you're talking about. So it very well will slough off a lot of companies that can't make that jump because of size or lack of knowledge of how to humanize their organizations. I think you have hit the nail on the head, and we certainly appreciate your contribution in this book, because we've been talking about it on the show with a number of guests about being authentic, being real, listening, right? And it all revolves around the same thing, is that you can't do with automation what you can do with a person-to-person interaction. You'll never be able to capture that moment. And this is where marketing is going to lead us. And it's not for the timid, and it's not for the weak-willed, because these are going to be some hard knocks coming at companies, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. But the key point is, we don't have a choice.
Yeah. No.
We don't have a choice. This is where the world is. It's undeniable. And this is what the customers want, and they will win. So in the end, the most human company will win. So let's start.
Very good. Very good. So, well, you know, Mark, we need to wrap up. I really appreciate your time today. We certainly want to promote the book. It's The Marketing Rebellion. You can go get it over at businessgrow.com/rebellion. Anything else you want to say to the digital marketer that's hearing this for the first time and has dropped their jaw?
Well, I mean, it's important to me that you see this as a book of hope. And I was very intentional with the design of the book, because rebellion is sort of a scary word. But then this is peace signs, right? This is the design of the book, because the message I want to give people is that, you know, we're going to be all right. And this is a book of hope. And, you know, and we're in it together. So let's do the hard work and make progress. So, don't be afraid. It does take courage to make change, but we don't have a choice. We have to do this.
Very good. Well, we got it on screen, and we're certainly going to have it in the show notes. We wish you all the luck in the world. And it really does. We've had a number of conversations with your books in the past. This one has a whole different resonation to it. All your books are fantastic. This one could be I know you got another book in the hopper. Yeah. You're always going to have it.
It's the best so far.
It's the best so far. So we highly recommend our audience to listen to it. And hopefully you'll be back again with your next book. I'm sure you're already chewing on it right now. This guy never stops. He never sleeps either. So everybody, if you haven't caught in the trail of Mark, please jump on the Twitter, Mark W. Schaefer, S-C-H-A-E-F. Go find him over at Facebook, mark.schaefer3, and LinkedIn at Mark W. Schaefer. We really appreciate your time, Mark, and we're going to be watching you from afar, and we're certainly going to lift up this book as much as we can, because this is really a clarion call to get right with your customers.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your support, and as always, thanks for being so well prepared and hosting such a wonderful conversation today.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate it greatly. All right. We'll see you next time, right? Soon you'll be a fourfer. Who knows? All right. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Mark, for your time today. All right. So thanks for listening to Edge of the Web Radio and watching at the Edge of the Web. Be sure to jump on our live stream as much as you can, because we certainly want to have and field questions to our guests as we interview them. Special thank you to our colleagues over at Site Strategics and to Tom, a man in the booth in the production today. Appreciate it.
Yep.
And certainly a thank you to our three-time guest, Mark Schaefer. Be sure to check out all the must-see videos and much, much more over at edgethewebradio.com. Hey, who are we actually going to be talking to next week, sir?
I mentioned it a couple shows ago, but Erin Robbins is coming back around here. She'll be in studio next week.
She's going to be in studio.
That's the plan.
That's the plan.
Yep.
Until she decides otherwise. Yeah. Okay. Well, Erin, if you're listening, we will have bourbon for you. So maybe that's an anchor that we can have to guarantee her presence. No harm, no foul. Erin's a busy, busy lady. All right. So check out all the must-see information over at edgeofthewebradio.com. edgeofthewebradio.com. We'll see you next week. Do not be a piece of cyber driftwood. Bye-bye.